We joke about the blue screen of death, but embedded systems, it's really not all that funny. Most systems need to keep running, even if one task decides to run away. This is one of the things real-time operating systems really excel at, and in this event, we find out how to ensure your system runs smoothly at all times. Hi, and welcome to everybody. This is Don Dingy, and I'm part of the editorial staff with Open Systems Media. I'll be your moderator for our program on Letting Down Your Guard, Migrating to Protected Memory and Partitions, sponsored by QNX Software Systems. Let's start by taking a quick look at our agenda. I'll familiarize you with our tools today. We'll have a couple quick thoughts from me, and then we'll hear from the people who really know what they're doing, our expert guest. And we'll take your questions in a question and answer session, which should be great. That's where you get to participate. If you've been with us before, here I am once again. Bear with me. If it's your first time, thanks for joining us. And here's some viewing tips for the session. You are seeing these slides on the right half of your screen. If you'd like to see a larger view of what's going on, there's great stuff on all these slides. Just click that Enlarge Slides button. You can also download these slides used today by clicking the Download button. You can invite a friend who should be watching this event and learning about this subject. Appreciate that. And then the participation box that I mentioned, the lower left-hand side of the screen there is the Ask a Question box. Our team will be selecting questions from your submissions for our Q&A session right after the presentation. So just type your question in that box and hit Submit Questions. Time permitting, we'll get to as many of your questions as possible. I promised a couple of quick thoughts to introduce this topic, so here we go. Along the theme of good fences make good neighbors, you've all lived in one of those neighborhoods where fences make all the difference, but real-time operating systems, it's not all that different, really. Maybe the implementation of a single address space with a context switch might be the simplest implementation, but you've all seen it. To just reset this widget, device, whatever it is, just pull the battery out. Sounds really simple, but even non-critical systems, that can be really annoying if one process hangs up, takes out everything. And we don't even want to mention what our subject is on today, safety critical systems, where that's just absolutely, totally unacceptable. Things can run away. Things can really happen badly. That's something we don't want happening. And some of you might have avoided this in your designs because it looks complicated, but setting up these fences might be a lot easier than it looks with the right set of tools, and that is what we are here to find out about today. Our presenter is David Randall. He has over 18 years of experience in the embedded real-time industry and software design, technical sales, marketing, and sales and business development at companies like Prosagis, Wind River Systems, and Green Hills Software. So he knows his real-time stuff. He currently holds the position of product marketing manager at QNX Software Systems. He holds a bachelor degree in computer science from Concordia University in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. And David, we are ready for your presentation.
Thank you very much, Don, and thank you everybody for joining us here this afternoon. So as Don mentioned, I'm going to lead you through the my perception of what it would take to get into a memory-protected, partitioned development environment. And we'll go to our first slide. So on the agenda, I want to visit some of the fundamentals, definitions of what it is that we're working with. Next, we'll look at the sandbox, which I term I'm using to define where it is that we're playing, where it is that our applications are going to run. The next section will be about good fences make good neighbors. So how do we play safe in the same sandbox? And then we'll be looking a little bit later at some of the details of the QNX Neutrino real-time embedded operating system. So what is an embedded system? I remember when I first got into this market, this industry, trying to explain to former colleagues working on workstations and desktop machines what exactly an embedded system was. And even for our own purposes, it's good to remind ourselves once again, you know, the common factor amongst all these systems, despite the increasing complexity and sophistication, we must appreciate the fundamental common definition of the systems that we work on that are called embedded systems, no matter what it is that they do. it's hard to explain to outsiders what it is we do and what we work on, but the near ubiquity of smart devices in our society helps us relate to popular culture such things as cell phones and smartphones push a lot more intelligence into the hands of everyday life. But as we still try to explain to our friends and family what an embedded system is, they'll never truly understand just how pervasive we are in their lives and what we are responsible for. So an embedded system device, just to wrap it up here, is a computer system inside something that is not necessarily a workstation or computer. It's comprised of hardware resources, common resources. There is a processing element, a microprocessor, possibly associated with a DSP or FPGA for specialized types of computing, some set of addressable memory, and interfaces to the rest of the system which it is embedded in, some physical connections such as sensors, actuators, and converters, communications with other elements in the system or to other systems, and, of course, power to keep it running. Also in an embedded system, and perhaps more increasingly important today, is embedded systems have been tasked to become smarter. Hardware isn't smart, even if you could use a truckload of it. So software is responsible for raising the intelligence and capacity and capability of these systems. So software includes the application software, device firmware, and runtime control and data plane management, or in other words, the operating system. So two ways to look at it. The embedded system is expected to continually perform its function on behalf of the requirements of the system that it's embedded in. Also, and this is a challenge, the embedded system is expected to perform its function within the bounds of its own resources, despite the demands that are put on it by the system in which it's embedded. So here's some concepts of what is a real-time system from noted Canadian computer scientist Donald Gillies, and from definition from the POSIX standard. It brings me back to when I was first programming, my first programming class, and we were assigned to implement a library lookup application with a tiny database of books in it. And after reading the user input, my program printed, "Please wait, processing, ... on the display while my program located the record. Except I naively inserted a counting loop before displaying the results, because the results came back too fast, and I was sure that good computer programs were intended to make you wait." So this is the perception between what we expect from general desktop computing systems and a real-time system, where we can't wait in a real-time system. Now, real-time is a concept that even after years of university study and several years working as a software designer and developer, I had not been introduced to the disciplines of real-time programming until I got into embedded systems and faced my first single-board computer with a multitasking priority-based operating system. So ours is a domain of a higher level of accountability and, in many cases, responsibility. Some systems can be referred to as soft, and others are hard. For instance, in a soft real-time system, audio and video frames can be dropped while still meeting minimum requirements. In hard real-time systems, though, any loss cannot be tolerated. Failure is critical and may result in damage, harm, or loss of life. The responsibility involved ranges from the spectrum of providing satisfactory level of service an experience to the user, or they'll buy another device, to guaranteeing the health and safety of those who depend on the device. So an embedded real-time system combines the stringent requirements of both of these domains. The system is embedded, it has limited resources, it must fit in a finite footprint, and it must produce real-time response to data input, user input, and react to it and process and deliver back some reaction to that input in a time frame that is real to the user. So due to the embedded resource constraints, these systems can't necessarily afford to add additional resources to meet the real-time constraints. And the increasing system features demand higher system response from the same hardware. So we're meeting this conflict of demanding more with the same resources. And a real-time system must utilize the bounded resources of its embedded system in the most optimal way so as to meet the bounded real-time commitments of the service that it must provide. So legacy embedded systems, real-time systems, have turned out some remarkably advanced electronic systems, but not everything really goes the way you would hope it would. Those who were around at the time remember Mars Pathfinder, which almost became the shiniest brick on the planet Mars due to a programming error, which is understandable, but a programming error that did not make itself fully evident until the device was in the field. Now, if it weren't for the resources of some of the most talented designers and developers out there, they really wouldn't have gotten past that problem. But these challenges are the type of things that legacy embedded systems really pose to the developers today, that fielding a system that cannot guarantee its availability is a significant liability to both the company that is designing and developing the system, as well as to the users who are going to be depending on it. So, using best practices, design, development, integration errors can be mitigated, but we can't get rid of them altogether. So the key is to be able to react to them at runtime, long past the laboratory workbench. When they're in the field, the system should be able to deal with those issues at that time. So now have a look at of what I call the sandbox, which is the development area. Some embedded real-time systems still use sandbox rules. Just like kids in a sandbox, everyone play nice and we'll all have a good time, but it happens. Somebody stumbles, reaches for something, and plants their foot into somebody else's sandcastle. And then, amidst all the tears, it's just time to go home. It's game over. So here's a very high-level view of what a legacy embedded real-time system looks like. The sandbox, it consists of the silicon, which is the CPU, and the memory. The application and system tasks occupy the same addressable memory space. The only thing that's keeping them from running into each other is best practices. Now, if we zoom down and look at an individual task, we'll see, like, what are they made of? What is a single task constructed of so that we can understand where these errors might come from? So the task consists of a code section, which is typically static in size. The data section, which, although static, may contain references into the globally available heap of system addressable memory. And the task stack, which is a dynamic construct, but it does have finite, it is finite in the limits that it can grow to. The code section, though it is benignly static at load time, contains all the potential to manipulate and corrupt its own resources and those of its neighbors. So we'll have a look at the next section. So how some of these code references take otherwise benign data statements and create errors which have absolutely no bounds as to what they can affect. A infinitely recursive function call will cause your stack to overflow, and in a non-memory protected system, that stack is just going to keep overflowing until it runs into something else. Addressing to zero or addressing an array out of its bounds, there's nothing to stop you from doing that. There's nothing to stop the code from doing that. And so it has every potential to create havoc on other parts of the system. Though best practices aim to mitigate this type of corruption, it can still happen. When it does, the results can manifest themselves in any number of ways. Memory access violations, such as accessing address zero, may seem obvious, or corruptions of another task's code or data. These typically bring an immediate halt to the system, but certain corruptions can be far more insidious. For example, changing the priority or run state of a task, possibly creating a priority inversion error. There's absolutely no predicting where a memory corruption is going to violate the system. So, you're here today because you want to hear about this, so you probably fully agree and are fully aware of the risks and potentials of designing in a single address space system. So let's look at how good fences make good neighbors. So we're back to the starting point. We have a system where everything is residing in the single address space. Well, where do you start? How do you decide like what you're going to partition here? Assuming that the mechanisms for memory partitioning are provided and all else remains equal, where do you begin to put up these fences? Well, simplistically, let's try simply isolating the application from the vital organs of the system. It's safe to assume, for the moment, that everything at the operating system level behaves coherently. Well, our application may still run amok, but at least we don't have to reset the computer. We can restart the application in debug mode and wade into the mess from there. This alone is going to save us a great deal of time, especially if you're working on a remote system and you don't have to physically go and hit a reset button in a lab somewhere else. But since we're now able to put up fences around things, we can take it a step further and break up the application into smaller protected pieces. Without too much analysis, we can partition application tasks into groups, perhaps even create a partition for each task if necessary. The rogue task will typically make itself quite evident early on. This is convenient for debugging, but it's not the ultimate goal. Recall earlier I mentioned that the key is to contain and deal with errors, especially at runtime. Some of the errors can be so insidious that they will only evidence themselves at runtime in a fully fielded system under load, when failure truly is not an option. In a real-world deployment, the application could provide a health monitor and recovery process that would detect and take action to mitigate the failure of another part of the application. In other words, the system stays alive and is capable of self-healing. Meanwhile, details of the error can be captured for later analysis. Also, since the groups of tasks can be stopped, started, unloaded, and loaded and reloaded, systems can be patched while they remain alive in the field. So the benefits of partitioned memory system in real-time embedded systems are clear: fault tolerance, high availability, and security. Obviously, starting the application design from scratch is the ideal situation to be in when designing a memory-protected system. All it requires is a contemporary CPU, most of which 32 and 64-bit CPUs do contain a memory management unit. But since this presentation is about the possibility of migration to memory-protected systems, the next bit we're going to talk about will give you the confidence so that you can lower your guard and approach the process with less trepidation. As we've seen so far, it is hard-pressed argument that there is any good reason to stay with the legacy single-address space system design. And yes, we can achieve the benefits starting with an existing design. There's no way of getting around it, and I'm not going to candy coat it, but we're looking at an OS port. The two main implications of an OS port are porting driver and hardware-related code and porting application code. Driver hardware-related code is typically a one-time effort, and it's done by manual inspection of the existing hardware and existing drivers. Porting the application code is going to likely be the most significant portion of the effort. To help in the porting of the driver and hardware-specific code, it may be possible then to leverage the availability of device drivers for common device hardware interfaces from the OS vendor from which you will get your new system, the memory-protected system. There are two main strategies to deal with the legacy application code. You can develop a porting library that provides legacy API, or emulation layer, while implementing it using the underlying API calls of the new OS. Or you can dig right into the application code and replace legacy functions with appropriate native OS calls for the new OS. Now, this can be done manually and to some extent automatically through the use of code parsing tools. If at all possible, you can leverage the use of standards-based APIs in your legacy application. For instance, if you've designed using POSIX, most commercial OSs today do support, to some degree or other, a POSIX interface. As we've seen earlier, for a quick start, it's possible to put the entire application into its own unique address space. So without giving further consideration to how to break up the application, we just put the whole thing in there, and in this case, we're going to rely on an OS abstraction layer. So the application is going to run in somewhat of an emulation mode on the new native operating system. The next step of partitioning the application will highlight how tightly or loosely coupled aspects of the application are, which will help direct the optimal partitioning of the application. In this way, native inter-process communication mechanisms can be employed, incurring a minimal overhead. So another thing is, we've come this far and have not yet mentioned standard or certification or criteria. It is crucial to move in the direction of memory-protected system design in order to simply build reliable and secure systems without any more requirement than delivering the best possible solution to the end user. As I mentioned, for all intents and purposes, you're going to be considering a new OS as part of your migration process. Some commercial OS vendors are relatively new to the domain of memory-protected systems. They mostly target designs that are destined for some type of certification. And by putting those criteria first, they encumber the migration process. Some are newly designed systems from vendors who have long promoted and supported legacy single address space systems, and their systems are not even backwards compatible with their legacy systems. Now, I'm going to introduce a commercial real-time operating system that is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, and has been fundamentally based on protected memory architecture since its inception. We'll have a look at further advanced benefits that such a mature and proven in use solution can offer. So we're talking about now the QNX Neutrino real-time embedded operating system. In the case of Neutrino, the operating system itself stacks up differently from most other legacy systems. The core OS is a true microkernel, retaining the very crucial elements required to execute a real-time application. Most everything else that is often considered part of a monolithic operating system occupies its own process or address space, just as application process and address spaces. In addition, device drivers also reside outside the kernel in their own spaces. The benefit here is clear, allowing a driver to be started, stopped, and upgraded on the fly without stopping the kernel. All these spaces are connected on a common message bus to the kernel, which defines the central nervous system of Neutrino. So in the diagram here, we've got the various components of the operating system, drivers, applications, and middleware components as well, file systems and networking stacks. Not only do partitions provide guarantees of protected memory, but also scheduling guarantees. Partitions can be allocated specific amounts of CPU time. Adaptive partitioning further allows the runtime system to redistribute available CPU time when the system is under a lighter load and return to the guarantees when load increases. Available for some time but growing in demand in more contemporary systems is multi-core support through symmetric, asymmetric, and bound multiprocessing, which distributes partitions across processing cores as appropriate. Now, I talked earlier about a porting layer or migration emulation to bring your legacy systems to a memory-protected partitioned architecture. So QNX offers a migration kit which allows you to port single address space-based VxWorks 5.x applications to QNX Neutrino up to 6.x releases. It has very in-depth VxWorks porting guide, 80 pages of technical content, including all the details you need to know, architectural comparisons, memory accessibility differences, inter-process communication differences between standard components that you would use, such as message queues, shared memories, watchdog timers, exception handling. There is startup code that you can insert into your application to get it going without having to have an in-depth knowledge of all the initializations that are required for Neutrino. Networking build environments, you're going to have to modify make files to modify your build process. And then documentation on recommended porting methodologies. The porting layer implements the key VxWorks functions. Functionally equivalent implementation to the VxWorks API calls and provides code compatibility with legacy code. The complete VxWorks system is encapsulated inside one process under QNX Neutrino. So this is the image that I presented earlier where the entire application can be inserted into one protected memory address space. It covers the majority of the core VxWorks API, the networking API, and the emulation layer is provided as a library. There's a no-cost product evaluation of the QNX Momentix development suite. There's a full suite of RTOS tools, BSPs, driver development kits, documentation, and more, plus the porting guide and evaluation risk-free preview of migration benefits and the scope. So along with QNX Neutrino RTOS, its complement is the QNX Momentix development suite, which is a complete Eclipse-based IDE providing you the latest and advanced software development and debugging and profiling tools, which complement the features that are provided by the QNX Neutrino RTOS for advanced features such as the asymmetric and symmetric multiprocessing, which Neutrino has supported since 1997, perhaps one of the earliest real-time operating systems to support symmetric multiprocessing. So this brings me to the end of my slide set presentation. I'm going to turn the microphone back over to Don Dingy at the head office and ask him to take it from there. Thank you.
At the head office. That's news to me. Great presentation, David. Thank you. We'll leave David's email address here for a second. We are seeing all your questions. Time may not permit or detail may not permit us getting to everything, but we will make an attempt to get back to you. The team at QNX will see everything, so they'll be able to follow up with you. But we definitely want to take on some questions verbally, and I want to introduce a second part of the team who will be helping us with this Q&A session. Andy Gretz has been a software developer and designer for over 20 years. He's worked at companies large and small with a diverse range of responsibilities in embedded software development and consulting. His accomplishments include some pretty impressive things. He's designer of the HP 100 LX, HP 200 LX Palm Top Database and GUI, and the HP Omnibook Notebook BIOS, and he was the lead embedded software architect at OnStar for a while. He has held the position of Worldwide Automotive Field App Engineer and currently works as a product marketing manager at Kunix Software Systems. So David and Andy are both available for us to take questions. And I wanted to start with a good question from the audience here. And I'm going to kind of toss this out to either David or Andy to take. But actually, let's back up to the slide here 1 second. You had a mention of adaptive partitioning, and I want to make sure we go back to where that was. Here we go. The question came in, what is adaptive partitioning? Is it done at build time, or is it done at runtime? Maybe you guys can describe a little bit about how that actually works.
Sure, Don. This is Andy speaking, and I'd love to talk about that. So adaptive partitioning is the ability for the scheduler to take different partitions, different processes, assign them to partitions, and those partitions are given a guaranteed amount of CPU execution time. So this is a scheduling algorithm that's used in addition to just strict priority levels. So normally if you think about just the priority systems of threads executing in an embedded system, you've got high priority threads and those will execute until completion and then next highest priority thread executes, et cetera. The problem that has is that if you've got things that are executing that take up an awful lot of CPU time in a kind of an unanticipated way, then you'll end up starving some of the lower priority threads. So the ability to separate those processes and say, well, you know, even in a high priority system, you've got, you know, things that you want to execute, but you still want to give some small percentage of that execution time to other threads, you can definitely do that. And that this lets you, you know, basically run background tasks or something and ensure that they don't starve or do even other higher, you know, maybe not as high or critical processing tasks, but still let those get done. So the actual question that you asked was about the compile time or runtime, and it's actually something you can do for both. So it's something that you could set up so that the partitions are configured basically at system boot time and then locked down so that they are unable to be changed. And one reason that you might want to do that is just from a validation or from a certification standpoint, such that once you've actually verified that the partitions actually operate the way that you think, then you can lock them down. But you can also have that dynamic so that you could potentially add a sandbox to create another partition for processes that are coming down in a dynamic sort of fashion, either loaded over the internet.
That's a good point. That's a feature I've heard you guys talk about previously on other subjects is maybe you can do something during development, and then when you figure out what your resources actually look like and want to deploy, you can lock things down so they're the behaviors as you expected it to be during development. It doesn't change, or you can let the scheduler figure it out, right? That's an interesting feature. Great answer to that question. Let's try another one here. So fairly lengthy question here, but I'm going to kind of cut to the chase here. Strong enough partitioning to be able to assure safety, security, and I think the question is kind of pointing at possible certification of such. So how does Kunix Neutrino provide stronger, better partitioning than, say, just running the apps in multiple processes? What sort of aspects make software versus hardware partitioning stronger or different?
Right. So I think that question is addressed. This is Andy again. I think that question is addressing a couple different aspects of sort of the whole partitioning question. And to bring it back to the adaptive partitioning,
First to say, why is that different than just running multiple processes under the same OS? Well, the one clear factor is that even though those multiple processes are running independent of each other, they are still all affected by the same scheduler. And there's only one CPU if it's a single core, but even in a multi-core system, you know, there's only a limited number of CPU resources. So, you know, you can have a rogue process of a high priority still take over the system or still have unintended behavior. And partitioning allows you to effectively protect against that type of behavior. So that's really why it's some additional guarantee beyond just separating a process or separating a task into multiple different processes. So one of the other aspects of that question is why is that not as strong as hardware partitioning? And I probably wouldn't phrase it quite that way. I would say, how is it different than hardware partitioning? So one way to think about hardware partitioning is to basically take multiple different CPU resources. So for example, if you're going to have a multi-core system, you dedicate one set of processes to one CPU and another set to another CPU. I mean, that's an example of hardware partitioning, and that's something that, you know, certainly that we support through a process called bound multiprocessing. But one thing that doesn't do is it doesn't allow you to have the ability to really take advantage of idle time on one process or the other. So it's good from the standpoint that you know exactly what's operating on what processor at every instant because you've fixed that. But the reason that adaptive partitioning is different is because it does allow you to have idle time, and any idle time that's in one partition, even though there's a guarantee of like 20% on that partition, if it's only using 5%, then that 15% in a hardware partition system would go to waste, whereas in an adaptive partitioning setup, that 15% could be distributed among the other partitions, so the more useful work can be done.
Isn't that often a requirement of the safety certification process that you kind of have to guarantee how much you've got left over? I know some of the defense requirements are written that way, but are the safety requirements?
There certainly are requirements that do require that, and from that standpoint, if you need to lock down the partitioning such that it's fixed for those processes, you can do so. In a lot of scenarios or in a lot of systems, that's not necessarily a hard requirement, and so that's why having the adaptive partitioning flexibility is kind of nice for those systems.
Super. So let's go back in the time machine a little bit and maybe target why this is news in some cases. Designers, to some extent, have avoided MMUs, at least in the past, because there was a perceived performance penalty. Whether that was real or not is debatable, but there was a perceived performance penalty for having to use the MMUs. So if people didn't have to implement them, they didn't. So could you comment on a couple of aspects of that? How does today's RTOS and maybe specifically QNX or maybe more in general, how does today's RTOS perform with an MMU? And are there some architectures that are better than others at handling these types of tasks?
Sure, that's an excellent question, Don. So to talk about that from a historical standpoint, if you look at how processors used to be developed when there was no concept of virtual addressing, there was really just the ability for an address that was on the address bus to be fetched from physical memory and then brought into the CPU. Even in those systems where they're relatively simplistic, eventually you get to the point where you have to have a cache on the CPU because the memory interface is too slow. So if you kind of move through historically, what had to have happened is that when you start to introduce those features, the ability to separate address space into virtual process spaces, there does have to be some calculation that's done by the CPU. So the CPU has to take the address that's being put either for a code or a data fetch, And then has to translate that address, which is a virtual address, into a physical one. So that requires some amount of computation and some amount of lookup. So there's a lookup that happens with respect to what that process is. There's a specific set of lookup tables that indicate what the mapping is that the OS maintains. And then a calculation to basically, you know, for an offset into the memory block. All of that stuff does take some amount of time, but the amount of time it takes pales to the amount of time that's required to actually refresh out of memory. So the fact that you have to pull resource out of memory, unless it's in the cache already, causes that to be a slowdown. But because you've got the ability to have multiple levels of cache and you've got physical memory in there that has to be looked up, there is a thing that most modern CPUs that do support MMU have, and that's called a TLB, or translation look-ahead buffer. And that is effectively takes the virtual address, and it's a cache for the calculated address of where that is in physical memory. So a lot of the performance that, because those calculations have to be done effectively all the time, even on the RAM that already may be in the cache, that TLB performance and how the OS manages that TLB actually has a huge impact on what the performance, if the performance of a virtual address space is effectively transparent or if it's pretty significant. To give some examples of that, in our operating system, I can't remember exactly when, but we did introduce the ability to take advantage of effectively the largest possible TLB sizes that the CPU provided. I believe that was during the 6.3.2 release. But that caused a pretty significant impact for performance in terms of code that does an awful lot of jumps and things like that also might invalidate the cache. So all of that said, most OSs today are going to be, unless they're a single task threaded operating system, are going to actually be operating in a protected mode. And most of that is hidden from the actual software developer. And in terms of performance, provided that they're actually, running things that are exercising a lot of code that is repeated, and so therefore they're utilizing the cached TLB entries, they're not really going to notice those performance penalties. Because basically once the CPU does that calculation, that calculation is effectively already cached. And I think the other thing to note is that it's well worth the benefit that you get for that almost transparent operation of the protected execution, because you're able to develop code that's far more robust than you'd be able to without having those processes in place and while having that assistance from the CPU.
Yeah, definitely. As David's slides mentioned, today's advanced 32-bit architectures, even larger, right? Sufficient clock speeds, good caching strategy, able to keep up with computations for the most part. But I'm glad you mentioned the complexity, because this is a really good transition to our next question, talking about translation look-aside buffers and caching strategies and all those types of things. So this all works if we're using your drivers, third-party drivers, drivers that have been tested, written to the APIs, know about the internals. But one of the things David mentioned was porting legacy code. What does this mean if somebody's got a device driver that relies on user space memory structures? Do we need to know the internals of the MMU implementation to rewrite it? In other words, do they have to learn all that stuff to be able to deal with this, or is there another easier way?
Right. So that's also another good question, and the answer to that is really no, that they don't have to learn anything new, especially, you know, programming within the QNX framework. Basically, writing a device driver is the same as writing an application. With other, you know, memory-protected operating systems, you still can write code like that, but you do have to do some a little bit of adaptation to do that. But to talk about really what the device driver author needs to do, I mean, if they've got user space stuff that they need to access, they can just go ahead and you know, do that allocation through a block, you know, malloc or whatever it is, just the same old traditional structures they'd use from an application level within the device driver. And effectively, the OS takes care of all the mapping, all the setting up of all those special structures, all of that stuff. The same thing is if you want to access memory that's you know, physically located on, you know, the processor or physically off of some other peripheral. In that case, you can't just access that directly, so that does require a little bit of work on your part, but it's a very simple bit of work, and that's you know, the looking up the physical address and actually creating a pointer to a virtual address. So, you know, there's a handful of APIs that will actually do that for you in a couple of different ways. But essentially, there are all those mapping functions that do that really would just take the place of the pointer that you would create that just goes to directly physical memory. So instead of assigning the physical address, you assign the result of a function where you pass in the physical address and it returns you a virtual address. So there are a couple of tweaks that you'd have to do, and probably the one other tweak that you would have to do is if your code that was using user space memory is making assumptions that the application has access to that user space. Because once you've actually separated it all into separate processes, of course, anything that's in the user space of the device driver won't be accessible to, you know, any arbitrary application that's calling it. So if that's the case where you are creating structures in some means and you need to share them with the application, you still can do that, and you do that through making a shared memory call. So it's very similar to what I was talking about, mapping from physical memory to virtual space. You basically do the exact same thing, but you're actually asking for a block of memory that can be mapped as shared memory. You get back a pointer. The pointer that you get back in your address space from the device driver might be a completely different address than one that the application asks for. The application asks for a block at that same address. But nevertheless, they'll both point to the same block of physical RAM, so they'll both have the ability to both look at those same structures.
Okay, so it's really just good housekeeping and probably not anything that somebody that's sophisticated enough to have written a device driver isn't used to as far as claiming and releasing memory blocks anyway, from the sound of it. I mean, it sounds fairly...
It's fairly actually pretty straightforward. Yep, yeah, exactly.
Okay, super. So we got one other one here on debugging tools. What does the debugger know, and what are the differences in dealing with a debugger that's going through an MMU, where the situation's going through an MMU, and how do you tell what's going on in and around your code? Are there some tools that expose what the MMU is actually doing, or again, is that simpler than it sounds, or what? How do your tools support actual debugging of these virtual addresses?
Yep. So that's actually another good question. So from at least from the QNX standpoint, you know, the Momentix IDE from does debugging from a process standpoint. And at that point, all of the addresses that you deal with from within the debugger are all virtual ones. They're all referring to pointers that reside in your application, and they're all automatically mapped to physical RAM as required. You can get to a lower level of detail if you'd like to. So, you know, there are occasions where, like, for example, if you're programming a DMA controller or something like that where you need to be doing mapping between the virtual and the physical addresses, and in those particular situations, you need to have a lower level of access. You can use JTAG, and then the JTAG tools would be aware of the processes and be able to actually do that translation. But for the most part, when you're actually dealing with code and dealing with, you know, setting breakpoints or examining memory or anything like that, you really don't even worry about the fact that you're looking at virtual addresses and that they're not physical. The debugger completely takes care of it. You can kind of forget that your process isn't the only thing in the system. You can just think of it as, you know, you're looking at the entire system, and that one process that's running really is kind of all you need to care about.
Interesting. One wrap-up question. I'm going to let you both have some closing thoughts. So how do you see the evolution? Are people taking on MMU, partitioned tasks as the processor hardware, like we talked about, is caught up? So now I guess the question is, we've got better processor hardware. We've got better OS support for MMU. Do you see people taking this on, and do you have some good stories? We had some kind of counter stories to that, but do you have a good example of the benefits of where somebody's implemented the MMU and seen all that? I'll let both of you comment on that, and then we can close out.
Okay, well, I think, Don, I'll go ahead and take that first. I mean, from my standpoint, you know, any of the customers that we would deal with that are coming from, you know, a roll-your-own type of environment where they've created their own OS. In a lot of those cases, in fact, the vast majority of those cases, people don't bother to do the protected memory because it is quite complicated. It's very difficult to get that started by yourself. And so they come from an environment where they are moving bodies of code into something that has all the protected address space. And, you know, and I think there's a couple of reasons for doing that transition. One is just the hardware has become cheap enough where, you know, it's extremely easy to get ARM hardware now that's cost competitive. So it's got a 32-bit, it's got an MMU, and it performs, and in a similar price range to, you know, 32-bit hardware that doesn't have the MMU or doesn't have a full MMU anyway. So that actually really kind of opens up the motion to get into those processors. And once they do that, I mean, I know I've worked with customers who have moved code over and have found bugs that have been in their system for a while, maybe latent, and could be explaining some of the random field failures that they had before. But they really didn't detect them because, you know, there wasn't any real way to tie back the cause and effect relationship of some, you know, errant bug. As soon as they move it into a process protected realm, those bugs become very apparent because they instantly cause those processes to crash. So I know at least in one hands-on experience of dealing with a customer, I mean, they were delighted to actually get that level of help. And I think, you know, with that, they kind of, it really sort of opened their eyes and they said, oh, okay, well, this is really what it's all about. This is why we can really kind of use the same level of hardware effectively and, you know, really improve the quality of the product. I don't know, Dave, if you've got anything else that you wanted to add to that.
Any last thoughts on that or any other topic you'd like to close with, David?
Well, from my background, you can see that I have worked in that legacy space, which is a single address memory space, and developed applications for that. And I particularly mentioned that the QNX, you know, Neutrino operating system was not designed to meet any specific certification requirements, but certainly if it is a requirement of your application to be submitted to some certification body today for safety critical or pretty much any contemporary, you're going to have to provide support for protected partitioned systems to guarantee high availability. I have some very recent experience in the software-defined radio industry. And for the military market, the software communications architecture requires fundamentally a process model, a memory-protected process model, as well as real-time capabilities. And, you know, so as I mentioned also, Neutrino was developed 30 years ago, and today it is the only commercial RTOS that has exceeded the U.S. Department of Defense JTRS SCA 2.2 certification in an actual fielded radio system. So it is becoming necessarily the way to go if you're going to get certification, and other than that, it's just the right thing to do.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think to sum that up, there's no reason not to do this along those comments. I mean, the hardware's here, the operating system is here, they're straightforward to deal with. I mean, that's an interesting point. Great question and answer session, guys. Want to thank everyone, and we'll go ahead and close out. We have just learned about dealing with RTOS strategies in letting down your guard, migrating to protected memory and partitions from our featured guests, David Randall and Andy Gritz. Thanks to them for sharing their expertise and to QNX Software Systems for sponsoring this event. This event and many other eCasts are archived at the URL being shown on your screen right now. These archived events can be replayed at your convenience. We would certainly enjoy hearing how we did with this program. Please contact us at the email address shown, which gets you to our fabulous digital content manager, Christine Long. A big thanks to her, as always. And thanks to all of you for being with us during this event. Please join us again soon on behalf of our guests and all of us here at Open Systems Media. This is Don Dingy saying find something good, build something better, and help someone be happy today. See you soon.